It's wabbit season. Oh boy, wabbit wax.
Say, Doc, are you trying to get yourself in trouble with the law? This ain't wabbit hunting season.
It's not?
No, it's duck hunting season. That, sir, is an investigated fabrication. It's wabbit season. Duck season. Wabbit season. Duck season. Wabbit season. Duck season. Wabbit season. Wabbit season. Duck season. Wabbit season. I say it's duck season, and I say fire.
Ah, Looney Tunes. That classic scene with Bugs Bunny, Daffy Duck, and Elmer Fudd gives us a window into hunting seasons from cartoon animals' point of view. As Missouri hunters get ready for deer, bobcat, and squirrel season, KCUR's Central Standard is taking another perspective, the conservationist's point of view. I'm Gina Kaufman, and I'd like to welcome James Worley to the studio. He's an educational specialist with the Missouri Department of Conservation. He teaches classes of all kinds of things, including a recent one I personally found intriguing on how to dress and clean a gray squirrel. Hi, James.
Good morning.
We're also joined by Bob Jones, whose relationship with hunting is somewhat unexpected. He's a professor of art at Truman State University. He's a hunter himself, and he teaches a class called Hunting in America. Welcome to Central Standard, Bob.
Good morning. Glad to be here.
So that old Looney Tunes vignette we heard, the rabbit season and duck season debacle, James, why do we have hunting seasons at all?
Well, hunting is a major part of the tradition in this country. A lot of people came to this country for the freedoms to hunt and fish and not be controlled by the government as they were back in Europe. Only the royalty could hunt. But in the United States, we all have the privilege to go hunting and fishing.
So why can you only hunt certain animals at certain times of year?
Well, all of the hunting seasons and limits are scientifically based. We have a great staff of wildlife biologists that conduct surveys and count numbers of animals and look at the habitat availability and then adjust the hunting seasons to keep the population at a desirable level.
What hunting seasons open this weekend in Missouri?
Well, the big one is firearms deer season, which is our most popular hunting season in Missouri. We actually sell a little over 800,000 deer tags a year. So you remember the parade a couple of weeks ago with 800,000 people dressed in blue. There'll be 800,000 people dressed in hunter orange this weekend.
Wow, that is a lot. So let's start by hearing a little more about both of your personal relationships with hunting. I'll start with you, Bob. When did you first start hunting?
Well, I actually started hunting in about 1981. I had been around hunting all my life and was introduced to hunting by my grandfather back when I was just a small child, and we'd go visit in the Washita Valley in Arkansas. And then my father hunted as well, but I didn't actually start hunting myself till about 1981.
How old were you?
Well, I just moved to Kirksville, Missouri here at Truman State University, so I was about 30 years old.
What inspired you at about 30 years old to take it up, having been around it all your life and still not done it at that point?
I just hadn't had an opportunity, frankly. I grew up in Texas, and there, most of the land was under lease, and if you didn't know someone who had a lease that you could hunt on, then there was no place to go.
Huh, that's really interesting. James, is Missouri like kind of an exceptional place in the availability of public hunting lands?
We have a lot of public hunting lands in Missouri. There are some private leases, as there were in Texas, but not nearly the large percentage within the Kansas City area. Within an hour's drive, there's lots of places you can go hunting without having to pay for a lease.
So, Bob, I want to get more into why you hunt and what, well, first of all, you started at 30. What was that first experience like?
Well, the first experience was actually bow hunting. My colleague, who was the person that designed this course I now teach, tried to convince me to become a bow hunter. And I was of the opinion that no one could really get interested in bow hunting. But he loaned me a bow, and I bought some arrows, and he taught me that I was wrong. And that led from bow hunting to quail hunting to rabbit hunting to pheasant hunting and to deer hunting during firearm seasons, those kinds of things. So,
you know, I've never been hunting. I'll just acknowledge that right now. And I wonder if you can help me understand what hunting is like, how you prepare, what some of the rituals are. Can you take me through, Bob, a day where you're going to go hunting?
Well, it starts very early in the morning, usually. But typically what I would do is the night before prepare the things that I was going to need, my lunch, things like that, and make certain that if it was a firearm I was using, that it was clean and functioning correctly, and already sighted in the scope if one was to be used, had everything in my backpack that I needed, and made certain I had my Hunter Orange clothing with me as well. And then we'd get up and go to my friend's house, my colleague's house. We would load up and head to public land here in Missouri to hunt, on which to hunt, because we didn't own any private land at the time, and climb up in a tree for deer hunting and sit there all day and enjoy nature. What I found was hunting became an episode where I didn't want to kill anything necessarily because it would end my season. So I would spend a month sitting in trees every day to watch the wildlife and tell Mother Nature she owed me one when I let a deer walk by or something like that.
So you're making a little deal. But you do sometimes actually hunt an animal, right?
Oh, yes, I do. And you know, obviously, if a nice buck or something that I wanted to take walk by, I didn't pass. I would take the deer. I was there to hopefully kill a deer and take back and eat. So I just didn't feel the urge or the necessity to kill everything that walked by. It wasn't necessary to do that. And so there were animals that I elected to let walk and thinking that maybe at some point something would come and I could take it. I actually hunted 8 years before I killed my first deer with a bow.
Tell me about that experience. I mean, talk to me about that moment.
Well, the moment was kind of interesting. First of all, it took 3 shots. I had set up my stand in a situation over a scrape, hoping that a buck would come in to check that scrape in the morning, thinking that I would be an advantage point to take advantage of that that shot. However, the deer came at some point the night before and it made a separate scrape under the tree that I happened to be in. And my shooting lane wasn't as clear as I had hoped. So the first arrow I shot hit a little limb and deflected. The deer came back. I tried to make the shot again, hit the same little limb. It deflected a second time. And the third time, the deer came back from a different vantage point, and I was able to make a clear killing shot and was really excited about the whole thing.
Yeah, I mean, did you have any misgivings? This is your first time taking the life of an animal.
Oh, no. I had actually taken the life of animals before. I had hunted, not on a regular basis. I had been bird hunting and rabbit hunting with my father, and I had actually killed a rabbit, so it wasn't the first time that I'd ever taken one. It was the first time I'd taken anything like a deer. There was a sense of excitement. There was also, when I walked up on the deer and saw it lying there, there was that urge to touch it, to feel it, and a sense of guilt to a certain extent because it had given its life for me. And I made certain that I took that deer and took it in and had it butchered, and we ate all of it, you know.
You know, James, I wonder if you experience that moment as a hunter the way Bob does.
I think it's the one thing that unites all hunters is that connection that we have with the animals that we pursue and the animals that we take. Hunting and fishing have been a part of my life since before I can remember. My whole family hunted and fished, and I've done it since pretty much I was old enough to walk. So been a part of my life. But even today, every animal that I take, just like Bob does, I respect it and make sure I use all of the edible portions and use all of that animal that I could possibly use.
What do you like about hunting, James?
What's not to like? I love the anticipation of upcoming season. I love the scouting, all the prep work.
Scouting, explain that.
Going out before the season opens and looking at the habitat, looking for food sources, looking for sign, trails, scrapes, rubs, just evidence of deer being there, and actually spotting the deer is a bonus as well. And the strategy involved in putting yourself to be in the right place at the right time.
What typically inspires people to come learn how to hunt in one of your classes?
Well, we have our Field to Fork classes, which are a really unique program that we have this year, where we're pairing some of the more popular local chefs together with different kinds of wild game. And the attendees are definitely a varied group. We have some families, mothers and fathers. It's an adult-only program, but they're coming in wanting to learn about how to process game and cook game and fish so that they can take their children out hunting and fishing. We have some grizzled old hunters and fishermen that want to come in and maybe learn some new tricks. And then we have the curious foodies that want to come in and just understand the flavors and textures of wild game.
Is that last group kind of a new one attending your
classes? Yeah, that's definitely brand new, and it's the foodie community is always seeking out the new flavors and new tastes, and they've been really excited to try some of the interesting game and fish that we've had.
You're a conservationist. I mean, you work for the Department of Conservation teaching nature classes. It might seem counterintuitive to some of our listeners that hunting and conservation go hand in hand. I mean, some of us do tend to think of conservation in terms of leaving nature as we found it, which is not what hunters do.
Well, conservation is technically wise use of the resource. What you're talking about is preservation, which is no use of the resource.
And, uh-huh.
And we're all about using our resources in the best possible way. And making sure that it's scientifically based.
Can you explain in some more detail how hunters and conservationists kind of work together, at least in Missouri?
Absolutely. Habitat has a specific carrying capacity for different kinds of wildlife. The amount of, we're using deer for an example, amount of deer that a certain area can support health and health-wise and with conflict with all the stakeholders. We have a lot of people that are involved with deer. We have insurance agents who definitely don't want deer vehicle collisions. We have farmers who don't want their crops eaten. We have people that like to view wildlife and want to see deer, and we have hunters who want to have an opportunity to take deer to eat.
So let me just jump in and make sure I understand. When you're talking about how many deer an area can carry in good health, that's partly a consideration of the ecology, like food sources, like just how much ecologically that area can support deer. But part of it is those human considerations, like how many deer become a hazard to passing vehicles, for example?
Absolutely. The food, water, space is all a consideration. And every year there's less and less in that as we develop subdivisions and shopping malls and take away habitats where the deer are confined to smaller and smaller spaces. And that's where hunting comes in. When there's an overpopulation in a smaller area, we reduce the numbers so that they can live within that carrying capacity. Are less susceptible to disease and other conflicts with humans.
Bob Jones, what's the history of this relationship between conservation and hunting in this country? Is it new, or is this a new way of thinking about things as development really ramps up in our culture, or is this old?
It's actually fairly old. I think the first concern about conservation from a hunter's perspective came about with the introduction of sport hunting back in the late 1800s. And I know when I ask my students in a survey about sport hunting, they think it's all about having fun. But sport hunting was instrumental in helping with the conservation, because they began to see that in order to have hunting, we needed to have rules. Up until that point, hunting was wide open. If you saw animals any time of the year, you could take them for your own use. So there was market hunting taking place where people were harvesting the animals and selling them to restaurants or to high tanneries or whatever the purpose might be, whether it was a hummingbird for some kind of sachet to go in a woman's blouse or something like that. And with sport hunting, the hunters begin to say, you know, we need to think about this. So we need to allow these animals to breed and bear their young and be protected. We need to have seasons when it's okay to hunt. We need to think about the numbers of wildlife that are being taken. Let's set bag limits. Let's set daily limits. Let's protect their habitat. Let's protect them. And so with the introduction of those rules, that kind of changed the way hunting was being looked at the time. It also set up kind of a conflict between the non-sport hunters and the sport hunters. Most of the non-sport hunters were landowners who owned the land and felt they should be able to hunt the game anytime they wanted to because it was on their land. And the sport hunters adopted the idea that the game belonged to the nation and to the people, not to the land owners.
It's so interesting to me. It never occurred to me what a big part of the philosophy of hunting, land ownership and access to a resource, like what a big role that plays in everything you're saying, Bob.
It's tremendous, and it's still an issue in some cases with access. We're very fortunate, I think, in Missouri to have access to the land. But when we look at conservation and you look at what hunters have done, in 1937, for instance, there was a Federal Aid and Wildlife Restoration Act that was passed, and that became known as the Pittman-Robertson Act. And what that did was it placed an 11% excise tax on firearms and ammunition and hunting-related equipment. That money all goes toward conservation to a certain extent, for education, for scientific research, for funding, things like the Department of Natural Resources or Conservation Department in Missouri. That was something that the sport hunters wanted. You see that as revenue coming in. As a matter of fact, in 2011, the National Survey on Fishing and Hunting and Wildlife Associated Recreation reported that hunters spent a total of $33.7 billion that generated taxes that went into conservation, research, habitat restoration, wildlife management, those kinds of activities. So it's a tremendous amount of money that comes out of hunting to support conservation efforts. And that all started basically with sport hunting in the late 1800s.
James, I wonder if we can focus a little bit for a moment on deer hunting, because that is a big season, as you mentioned, opening this weekend. And I think the issue of deer overpopulation is one that people have some familiarity with. I mean, can you talk to me a little bit about the specifics of that situation in our area?
Oh, absolutely. And kind of talking about what Bob was referring to, in the 1930s, deer were almost extinct in the state due to, again, overhunting through market hunting and just wholesale disregard for the animal's well-being. They hunted them during breeding season and birthing season in the spring. Now we have 1.4 to 1.6 million deer in the state, which is a lot of deer running around. And hunters annually harvest around 200 to 250,000 deer a year. So imagine without that harvest, what our numbers would be like.
Are there other things people have tried, though?
There's several different methods have been tried. Relocation, capturing and relocating deer, which is actually one of the most ineffective methods because it puts so much stress on the deer to capture them and transport them.
I find moving stressful, too.
Yes, it is. And imagine being placed in a foreign land with no resources, no idea where the food is, no idea where the cover is. The survival rate is very, very small for deer that are relocated. Organizations have tried sterilization of deer. You capture the female deer and you remove their ovaries. ovaries. And that is, again, very ineffective because of a cost factor. It costs between $500 to $1,200 per deer. And you think of deer numbers in these areas are ranging from 100 to 125 deer per square mile. And at the tune of $1,000 per year, that adds up, $1,000 per deer adds up to be very expensive. And again, that deer is still out there. Even if she's been sterilized, she can still run into a car. She can still get into your garden and eat your tomatoes or your hostas and can still spread disease. So sterilization and relocation are two methods that have been tried. Been found to be very ineffective. Hunting has been proven to be the most cost-effective and effective method of controlling deer populations.
There have to be, though, dissenting voices when it comes to the ecological benefits of hunting.
Absolutely. There are people that don't understand the situation, don't understand the realities of the sheer number. They see the cute brown eyes and the beautiful fur and the deer prancing through the meadows like you see.
Everyone has seen Bambi.
Yeah, exactly. The anthropomorphization of animals is rampant among people that aren't familiar with the realities. But when you've seen what happens to deer whose populations have exploded and the deer become too crowded? We had a very large outbreak of hemorrhagic disease, and also known as blue tongue, and the deer suffer a very slow, painful death because of overcrowding.
James Worley, stay with me through the break, okay?
All right.
When KCUR's Central Standard returns, we'll continue our conversation about hunting and the environment. When we do, we'll hear a little more about the history of hunting in America and hunting as depicted in art. We'll also take your calls. What does hunting mean to you? 816-235-2888. I'm Gina Kaufman. Don't go away. We're back. It's Central Standard on KCUR, and I'm Gina Kaufman. We're here with James Worley and Bob Jones talking about the complex relationship between hunting and the environment. For some hunters, the sport is closely tied to conservation, but people hunt for all kinds of reasons. Why do you do it, or why don't you? 816-235-2888. Guys, in recent months, there was a huge story about an American dentist who illegally hunted a lion named Cecil in Zimbabwe in violation of that country's hunting regulations. The story, what really added to outrage over the story was that this was trophy hunting, which sparked a pretty big conversation about trophy hunting more broadly. James Worley of the Missouri Department of Conservation, do you think trophy hunting is different from hunting for food from an environmental perspective?
Absolutely. Hunting is, in Missouri anyway, is seen as more of a tradition and a method of population control and procurement of food. Venison is delicious. We actually have a program coming up next Tuesday on how to clean and prepare deer. We'll have some delicious venison dishes for people to try. We also have a Share the Harvest program where deer hunters can donate either all or part of the deer they take, and it's processed and fed to needy people around the state. So it's more about food. It's more about tradition. There are people that hunt for antlers, and shooting a big buck is an exciting, important part of a hunter's life, but there's not very many people out there that are focused on just trophies.
You know, we're seeing more and more of a connection, which some people might find strange, between vegetarianism and hunting. I mean, there's this small yet growing movement to only eat meat when you've killed the animal yourself. Mark Zuckerberg drew attention to it in 2011 when his annual self-improvement challenge was just that, to eat only meat that he had killed himself. James, does the connection surprise you?
Oh, absolutely not. Everyone is wanting to get close to their food. They want locally sourced, free range, non-GMO, antibiotic free. And the only way to ensure that is to either raise the animal yourself or go out and hunt or fish for it. You know that animal was healthy when you took it. You know exactly how it was taken care of from the time that you fired the shot until the time that it's on your fork and going into your mouth. So you have complete control over that, and you know it's safe for you and your family to eat.
Bob, what are your thoughts on this?
Well, we talk about this quite a bit in my my class, that the idea of organic meat has really gotten popular here lately, and I have books that I share with my students, but different authors who have were at one time or another vegetarians but began to want to get that organic meat, and James is correct. You know, there are many people who eat meat who think there's no reason to continue to hunt for meat because you can go to the supermarket and you can buy meat already packaged and ready to go. But what those people are doing, in my opinion, is they're removing themselves from the killing process. They don't identify with the fact that that beef that they just purchased was at one time a big brown-eyed animal that someone maybe loved, and now they're eating it. And the hunter has taken responsibility for the killing process instead of hiring someone at a slaughterhouse to do the killing for them. And these people now that are moving toward eating organic meat and hunting organic meat have decided they want to step up and take the responsibility themselves and be a part of that and try to understand that connection to the hunting process. So
let's talk to Kim in Mission. Hi, Kim.
Hi there. When I turned on my radio this morning, I heard the gentleman speaking about the diseases and various things that deer go through when there's overpopulation. So I'm basically speaking from that perspective. I do want to say that I agree with hunting for personal use, but not for this voracious appetite that human beings have for meat. I feel that nature has a course and a rhythm, and if nature is providing a disease to stabilize the deer population, for man to insert himself in that is egocentric and unnecessary. So my question is more about, I agree with what I just heard the gentleman say, that people are cutting themselves out of the connection with these animals, and that is necessary because I think less meat would be consumed if you realized you were taking a life. But I'm also bothered by, I live in close to Shawnee Mission Park, and there was an absolute massacre that went on a few years back. And so that's kind of what's got me triggered this morning.
Let's hear what James Worley has to say about this, because I'm sure there are a lot of people who feel like him.
Well, humans have already inserted themselves into the equation. We've removed the natural predators of deer. We've extirpated the wolves and the mountain lions, which were the natural predators for deer. We've also encroached on their habitat. You talk about living in Shawnee Mission and that area, and there's houses all around where that used to be prairie and forest. We've reduced the deer's opportunity to roam. Deer typically have about 1,000-acre roaming habitat, and we've cut that into a small piece. So the deer are crowded into smaller areas due to our urban sprawl and our removal of the predators. So we have to step in and fix that balance, and hunting is a scientifically based tool to fix that and solve that problem that we've created by our development.
Let's talk to Bailey in St. Joe. Hi, Bailey.
Hi, it's nice to see you. I really don't eat meat other than the meat that I kill. I've grown up on a farm. My grandparents had a cattle farm that I was a part of, and then now I go deer hunting with my dad. I really enjoy, I guess I wouldn't enjoy killing animals, but I enjoy knowing where my meat is coming from and knowing the carbon footprint that my meat has, because the meat industry has such a high carbon footprint that it's nice to know that I, you know, am not contributing to that other than this small portion of the meat that I eat that I take care of myself personally.
Bailey, I don't have hunting experience myself, and maybe this is just a misconception, but as a female hunter, I'm just curious, do you see a lot of other female hunters out there?
I think it depends on where you're at. I personally hunt on my grandfather's land out in eastern Missouri, and it just kind of depends. There's definitely a handful of us, and growing up with only sisters and my dad, you know, only having daughters, you definitely get into it, especially, you know, when most of your cousins who live out on the farms as well are also men. So I think it just, a lot of women might be afraid to start out with it if they've never, you know, been around that. But it's a lot of fun, and I'd take anyone.
Thanks so much for your call, Bailey.
Thank you.
James, do you see a lot of female hunters?
It's a growing part of the population of hunters. There's actually percentage-wise more female hunters now than there ever has been. Actually, in my family, I have my brother's youngest daughter, my niece. She shot her first deer last year. And my aunt, she's a hunter. My grandmother's hunted. So in my family, I have three women that hunt. And I was actually duck hunting the last couple of days. And the area where I duck hunt, there's usually one or two women to about 50 men. But there are female hunters out there. Again, they tend to be not a large percentage of the hunting population, but they're definitely out there.
Could I?
Yeah, please jump in, Bob.
We found through surveys that the fastest growing demographic in hunters today is the female hunter. And they're growing at such a quick pace that they're impacting all aspects of the industry in terms of the clothing industry. Now, when you go buy camo, you hear people talking about, does this make me look fat? We see rifles that have pink camo, hunting knives with pink camo, pink hunting hats and so forth, and the women are really making a significant impact on hunting.
Well, Bob, I want to come back to you in just a second, but let's hear from one more caller. We've got Joe in Westwood on the line. Hi, Joe.
Good morning.
What can you share? What do you want to know?
I'm curious what part of a bobcat you eat, or for that matter, what part of a badger you eat. The gentleman was justifying all this by killing for food. Most people have never even seen a bobcat or a badger. They're not a threat. They're not overrunning the schools. Why is there a season on bobcats and badgers?
Okay, let's hear from James Worley on this.
Well, fur-bearing animals such as bobcats, badgers, coyotes, raccoons, different class of animals than deer or other game animals. Fur-bear populations tend to increase in areas where there's no hunting or trapping, and that causes a dramatic decrease in other animals such as rabbits or quail or pheasants. Maintaining predator populations at acceptable levels is beneficial for other wildlife as well. As far as the edible meat, I've eaten badger meat before. I've never eaten bobcat meat. I tend not to eat canines or felines, but I've eaten raccoon, I've eaten beaver, and they're all delicious if prepared properly. But again, it's more about controlling populations. You very rarely see bobcats because they're pretty sneaky, but there's a very large population of bobcats and foxes and coyotes, especially right here in the metropolitan area.
Interesting. Bob Jones, you teach a class on hunting in America, and I hear that you have a real focus on how hunting is depicted in art. How did you become interested in that?
Well, the course that I teach is called a Junior Interdisciplinary Seminar, and it's a course in which we introduce students to the idea that you can't solve a problem from a single perspective, that usually you have to come at it from multiple perspectives and to fully examine the issue. And so what I do basically is I talk about the history of this country and the history of art and literature with hunting as the central focus. And so we look at the historical information, and we also look at the art. And for instance, when the early colonial settlers were trying to entice people to come to this country to populate and colonize the country, they used art as a way to convince them this was the new Canaan, the new land of Eden, and the Garden of Eden, and to show them the paintings that were being done of the landscapes and the magnificent trees and mountains and those kinds of things to entice them to come here. And they also would put out pamphlets on the amount of game, the wildlife that was here, and encouraging people in Europe that had never had the opportunity to hunt to come here because there was land they could own and game they could harvest. And
does anything surprise you as you look at the depictions of hunting in American art over history? Anything that just caught your eye and really changed how you thought about things?
Not really, because I've been around it so much through my own personal past as an artist and with relatives. But things that people don't understand sometimes is that people were seeing was, or trying to depict, was somehow their love for the animals and being able to see them out in nature. But also some of the early settlers, some of the people over here wanted to show, a bit of what they were able to do to brag some, so they would always have themselves, their portraits painted with them and their,
yeah,
their regalia and their dogs and their wildlife that they had taken.
Bob, KCUR Central Standard has to take one more quick break. When we return, we'll wrap up this conversation and then we'll hear a story about getting stranded in Chicago with the local band. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay tuned. I'm Gina Kaufman, and you're listening to Central Standard on KCUR. My guests are James Worley, who works at the Missouri Department of Conservation's Anita Gorman Discovery Center, and Bob Jones. He's a hunter who teaches art at Truman State University. We've got just a couple of minutes left, so guys, before we go, I'm curious, as people get ready to go out hunting deer, pheasant, whatever else in Missouri this weekend, duck is a big one I hear. Do you have some do's and don'ts when it comes to hunting environmentally? I'll start with you, James.
Definitely make sure that you've read and understand all the regulations. The Department of Conservation has very easy to understand pamphlets and guides. I brought you a couple if you want to peruse those. And make sure you keep safety at foremost. Make sure you check the weather. We had these high winds the last couple of days, and make sure you don't go out in a boat when it's dangerous conditions. And make sure you understand firearm safety. So safety and understanding of the rules and regulations, really important.
Bob, what about you?
I try to tell people to leave the place cleaner than they found it, to pick up their spent shell casings, to remember, you know, that if you're eating lunch out in the woods, you bring all the trash back. And if you find trash out there while you're hunting, pick it up and bring it back with you. And try to look after and care for the habitat, the environment a little bit, and to, you know, make certain that your line of sight is clear. You know what's on the other side of the animal you're about to shoot at? Safety. You know, that's the main thing, is safety.
Bob, how would you like to see the conversation around hunting in our culture change, or would you like to see it change?
I would like to see it change because I think people misunderstand what hunting is all about. And even with my own students, when I talk to them, they see hunters as poachers. They associate hunters with poachers, and I try to tell them that in my mind, a poacher is not a hunter. They're a lawbreaker. They're someone who doesn't want to follow the rules, and that hunters really do care about the wildlife. They really do care about the environment. They really do care about what's happening out there in nature, and they want people to be a part of that. And my students even tell me that they know nothing about nature. They know nothing about wildlife. And I'd like to see that change. I'd like to see people become involved more with nature and not necessarily in hunting. What I require my students to do is I require them to hunt as a part of the course. They don't have to take a firearm. They can take a camera. But in order to do that hunting, they have to be able to tell me everything there is to know about that game species they're hunting, even with a camera, the seasons, the bag limits, the possession limits, everything associated with that hunt, just like they would have to know if they were carrying a firearm. I also tell them about opportunities to connect with the community beyond the classroom, maybe the share the harvest, to go and volunteer to unload the deer from the pickups and put them into the freezer trucks for the share the harvest program, and to help the butcher that's the processing plant that's taking these in participate with that. I ask them to go out and to do an interview, an oral history interview with a relative, maybe a grandparent.
I bet those are super interesting. You know, James, before we go, mm-hmm. I wonder if you have a hunting trip planned right now that you can tell us about.
I have a lot of hunting trips planned over the next several weeks. I'm going to do a little deer hunting this weekend myself, probably down around Stockton Lake or maybe Lake of the Ozarks. I haven't decided. It kind of depends on who's got the best deer report for me, and have lots of duck hunts planned. Several with family members. My mom, who actually became a Missouri Master Naturalist here the last few weeks, wants to go on her first duck hunt. She's not going to actually hunt, but she wants to be an observer and be out there and understand the process of hunting. So lots of good times with friends and family, lots of memories planned for the next several months.
What do you think about this idea? I mean, thinking about your mom, who might not hunt this time around, but she's going to go along. What do you think about this idea of taking a camera instead of a gun?
Oh, it's a great way to connect. It's a great way to bring back memories. I carry a camera with me as well, so I'm not always shooting animals with a firearm. Sometimes I'm taking pictures as well, and keeping those memories and posting them up on Facebook and showing that sunrise and showing that flock of birds that's working to your decoys is a great way to keep those memories in. And again, it's about the experience. It's not just about the kill. It's about being part of nature and being very close to your food.
James Worley of the Missouri Department of Conservation, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And Bob Jones, thanks for getting into this conversation about hunting and the environment with us today. I've really loved talking with you.
I've enjoyed being a part of it.